Welcome to the 260th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome, and thank you for listening. Hope this finds you all safe and healthy. I hope this finds you plant-based and moving. So, moving down here in Florida, I've been doing my running for the most part. I haven't gotten the pool yet. Starting to open up here, you can go rent a lane, but it seems a little complicated to rent a lane for me, so I've been putting that off, I guess. For now, I'm not sure if our swim run is still on or not. We haven't heard about it, but certainly there's lots of running in the future. So I've been continuing to follow a Galloway walk-run method, 2 minutes of running and 30 seconds of walking, and doing some speed drills and some cadence drills during the week, increasing the long runs on the weekend. So far, so good. I continue to do my big three as per Stuart McGill. If you're not familiar with Stuart McGill, he's a great researcher on spine health. I've had him on the podcast. Those involve a abdominal brace exercise that's kind of like a crunch, but not really, because you don't move your lower back. So it's all through the upper thoracic spine as far as a contraction in the abs. The other one is a bird dog. Bird dog is when one arm is extended and the opposite leg, and you hold that. You can also do various maneuvers while you're doing that. You can use weights. You can, increase the difficulty by moving your leg out and your arm out and make circles or squares. But it really helps a lot to engage the latissimus dorsi muscles, the quadratum lumborum muscles, as well as the abs and obliques. And, of course, planks with main emphasis on rotation to 45 and 90 degrees and holding those. So try to keep those going. And my suitcase carries, of course. That is a great exercise to stabilize the spine. I'm also focusing on, when I'm running, keeping my shoulders down and keeping my latissimus dorsi engaged. If you haven't thought about it, those are the muscles in your back. Over your shoulder blades, down into the lower part of your ribs, and then your quadratus lumborum connects. It's a muscle that connects your ribs to your pelvis. And so when you have your arm, you're upright and those are contracted, it really helps to stabilize your spine. So far, so good. Even helps when you're doing yard work, if you can think about that, and keep yourself braced. And we've been doing quite a bit of yard work as well, trying to get things back in shape after being gone to Houston for a while. It's mango season, mango mania down here. The mangoes are starting to be ripe. We picked some from our trees. Nothing better than Florida mangoes with all the different varieties. So it's a good time to be in Florida. Everything else is hot, hot, hot. That means getting out and running very, very early. I've started because of the other podcast that I did with Judge Mitchell. I've started a run group, leaving from a local park here in Port Charlotte. And, we started that this week. We're going to run Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And we're starting at 6, and we'll increase that time and mileage up as it goes, to try to get more people involved in running. It was actually great. Have people that haven't run in years and years and years starting to run again and realizing that they can run in their 60s. And people that have coronary artery disease are running, despite having been told that, you know, their exercise's career is over and kaput. So by eating a healthy plant-based diet, stabilizing the endothelial cells, we can get those people not only walking but running. It's all about getting a good technique and keeping good form and starting out slow. And I think the run-walk method is very helpful. So it's quite exciting. We have people that had chronic pain that are now running, starting to run. So it's all good. Anybody can join. We're on Facebook. It's called the Plant-Based Striders. Anybody can join the group. Welcome anybody to kick in and tell me about their runs. Tell me about their running stories. I think it's a good idea to be positive and encourage people from all ages and stages and motivation. So I'm having a good time at that. So we'll see how it goes. I'm going to continue training throughout the summer. So however it goes, I'll keep on running This week in nutrition class, we did a polenta. If you haven't made polenta, it's easy from cornmeal. We added sun-dried tomatoes and olives. And then this week I put our Fiesta bean chili over top of that. Makes for a good dinner. You can put the chili. We made chili in class as well. The Fiesta bean soup that's in our cookbook. We did that for one of the classes. That recipe is really good because it has the kitchen sink in it as far as nutrients in it. We put kale in there, mushrooms, peppers, tomatoes, pinto beans, black beans. So there's a variety, onions or leeks. We use leeks this week. So, you know, tons of fiber, a lot of antioxidants and phytonutrients. You get your nitric oxide by getting the kale in there. So that's great. Putting that over polenta makes it a little bit more hearty. You know, makes it last longer. So for people that are bigger and have bigger appetites that want to, you know, not have to eat a couple bowls of soup, you can have a big bowl of soup over polenta and it makes it really, really good. So while we're on the subject of nutrition, since this is a plant-based nutrition wellness podcast, I wanted to talk about a few things that have happened recently in the class and that I've heard around that I kind of wanted to address that I think applies to everybody. I think people put themselves in nutrition jail. And a couple things, you know, there's a lot about intermittent fasting. And I think people try to do a quick fix by trying to eat breakfast and then fast all the way to dinner. But unfortunately, what that ends up happening is people are really hungry and then they eat a small plant-based dinner and then they snack the rest of the afternoon or the rest of the evening. And I see that happening a lot in my practice. And it results in high glucoses in my diabetics and a lack of weight loss in other people. And, you know, intermittent fasting is great. I think the best way is to go to bed. That way you don't have to worry about it. You eat, close the kitchen, go to bed early, try to wake up, maybe do your run, and then go ahead and eat your breakfast and lunch and dinner accordingly. But I think when people wait all evening and then they have to sit around, because the evening is the snack time anyway of most people, they start watching TV, you see the commercials on TV about food, or somebody else in the house is snacking, and the next thing you know, they're overeating. And I think sometimes people study for their doctor's appointments and they try not to eat before they come in and they try to lose a quick couple of pounds, and It just never ever works. You have to have some rule about intermittent fasting. It just can't be, you know, you wait till you're hungry. So if you are thinking about intermittently fasting, you have to realize that you're going to have to deal with being hungry and putting that off. It's not about, you know, drizzling food in throughout the evening after you've waited all day long. That just doesn't really cut it for most people. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen people get into. The other thing is they make a plant-based dinner that they really don't like. They don't eat very much of it. I've heard a lot of people, and I tease my mother about this intermittently, is they get tired of chewing that raw salad. They get tired of eating raw salad. And then, you know, then they go way off the reservation, and they go from eating hardly nothing to eating everything in sight and eating all this bread. And, you know, they'll eat bread and potatoes and starches because they've limited themselves so much. They have a need for this. You know, their glycogen stores are down. And once they get started, it's very, very difficult to stop. So, you know, I think you have to, the best thing you can do is plan your menu and stick to it and find things that you like. And if you don't like what you're eating, you've got to readjust and find meals that you really do like that you can eat. We had soup, you know, twice this week, once over polenta, once not. We have one meal, every meal we have a salad with the soup. Had a piece of sourdough bread with the soup one evening, actually two evenings. So, and then I repurpose the soup over greens at lunchtime. So, you know, you don't have to cook every night. You have a couple of days where you kind of catch a break. I think the other thing that happens with a lot of people is they go in you know, full speed ahead. I'm going to do this. And they don't give themselves a break for, you know, maybe using some of those transition foods, and they try to go cold turkey. And that's one thing. If people have chest pain or people have cancer and you're really trying to make a quick difference, you're behind the eight ball. Yeah, I think you definitely get the biggest bang for your buck by being 100% plant-based, eating whole fruits and vegetables and whole grains and no oils and limiting your nuts considerably. I think that's the best way around. You know, I would limit your nuts completely if it's in the presence of heart disease and significant, you know, high cholesterol. But a lot of times people are just wanting to make this transition, and, you know, maybe they've got a newly diagnosis of high blood pressure. They just don't want to take cholesterol medication, so they say they're going to go all in. They're not prepared. They don't have menus. They don't know how to cook plant-based. They're not sure what goes with what. They don't know how to use spices. They have to use a bunch of recipes early on. They're trying to buy packaged food. They get all confused and frustrated. Their family doesn't want to eat what they want to eat. The next thing you know, they've just given it up completely. I heard somebody say this week, it's a little bit humorous, but they're too busy to be plant-based. They have too much going on in their life. They're involved in too many community activities, helping other people. And, you know, I want to say, and I did say, well, how can you possibly help somebody else change their life or change what you think is better for somebody else when you can't get your own life in order? And take time for your own health, because when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if you don't have your health, it's hard to help anybody else. It's hard to be a productive member of society if you're sick and you have to, you know, let's clean your own house up first and take some time to do that. And people think it's going to be easy and quick, and when it's not, then they give it up. So you got to give yourself a break. Most people can pull off breakfast, oatmeal, fruit. That's pretty easy in most instances. Then you can pull off a salad again at lunchtime, maybe leftovers, but dinner's hard. You know, dinner is really hard for a lot of people. And again, if you're not eating enough, then you get the munchies, and, you know, you're looking for all the snack food or all the substitutions of things that you do that made you sick. It gets very, very complicated. And it's very, very complicated if you've got to do recipes from the get-go. And, you know, that's why I think our classes, our nutrition classes, are so important, is because you get to be with other people. You get to see the struggles of other people, and you get to learn. You know, we do cooking tutorials and discuss how things go together and nutrients, how they go together, how to make a sauce that doesn't, you know, have oil or doesn't have a lot of nuts or other ingredients that's going to get you in trouble. How do you spot foods that are, on the shelf that are going to get you in trouble? I've seen, you know, people buy prepared foods, frozen dinners that, you know, lay big claims that, you know, they're heart healthy and they're plant-based and they're oil-free. But then when you go to look at the ingredients, they're full of nuts, tahini. The calories are low, so, you know, if a frozen entree has 230 calories and ends up having, you know, 8 grams of fat, then 8 times 9 calories per gram, that's 72. So you're up into 25-30% of your calories from fat, and you're basically back at a standard American diet, just plant-based. And so that doesn't do anybody any good. Again, their glucose will go up. You know, people get hungry after that, then they're starting to grab things. You know, people start to put sandwiches back in, you know, the peanut butter and jelly starts to creep back in, and, you know, the next thing you know, they're not getting the nutrients that they need. Basics, you got to focus on getting the greens and the fiber in, and, you know, those first, getting the fruit in, and then start to fill in around it, you know, to keep yourself full, either with grains, potatoes, but not necessarily both at each meal. So I tell people I want them to have beans and a grain or beans and a potato, but not, grains and a potato. I want them to make sure they're getting multiple vegetables in as well as their greens. So it's things that we go over, things that trip you up, snack foods that people think, you know, what's wrong with popcorn? Well, popcorn in and of itself, maybe not that bad if it's just, you know, some sort of popcorn that you put on the stove. But if you buy the kind that's in the bag, then you're going to have all kinds of chemicals, and most likely there's something going to go on it. And the reality of it is empty calories. It's not really getting you any nutrients. Fruit would be better. Maybe nothing would be better. So it's, again, all that stuff starts to pop in. And then, you know, you serve these, these cravings all the time. Once they're still there, they continue to be there. So you got to give yourself a break when you're first starting out. But then you have to start, you know, making some rules and refining as you go. And, you know, that's where, you know, we come in when we help people and talk about it. And there's so many things out there that people would like to tell you that, you know, what to do and tricks of the trade. But the reality of it is, it's got to be good food. You got to cover your bases with your greens and your antioxidants, and it's got to be something you like and it tastes good to you. So that's, where I am on that. The other thing that happened that I get irritated when I hear people saying that they're finally going to go visit family and the family's going to take them to some place like, you know, Red Lobster or Olive Garden when there's actually nothing there that somebody that has heart disease should be involved in. So, you know, if you're going to take somebody out to dinner and they're plant-based and there's absolutely no choice for them, that's not being considered, especially if you're a family member. And the fact that you take, you know, kids out to, you know, to start them in on the soft foods of places like that, it really, it's not saying much. I think that, I would hope that my daughter would tell my grandson someday that, and she's plant-based, that, your mom doesn't eat that kind of food, so we're not going to eat that kind of food while she's around because we have respect for her nutrition habits and maybe even try to make something special for, you know, your parent that's trying to avoid dying from cardiovascular disease. I just don't understand how people could be so self-centered that they're not supporting somebody else's effort to reverse cardiovascular disease. Even if they don't believe that a plant-based diet is necessary, support somebody. Because we all agree that plants, fruits and vegetables are healthy. They're not going to hurt anybody. And it wouldn't hurt anybody to have a couple meals that are fully plant-based. Other thing that I see people running into, breads like Dave's Killer Brand breads, store-bought breads, a lot of added oil, a lot of added sugar. Some of these have, if they don't have oil per se, the nuts and seeds can really increase the caloric density and increase the glucose in my diabetics. So, again, if you're going to do bread, I think you ought to make it yourself. Either use a sourdough is preferably, but at least commercial yeast, water, salt, and flour as a bread, as opposed to all these other additives that are on store-bought shelf bread or even bakery breads that have a bunch of eggs added into them. You got to watch it. I want to talk a little bit about trimethylamine oxide. And TMAO, you can measure it. You can get a blood test and measure it in your blood. High levels are strongly associated with inflammation and cardiovascular disease. There was a study referenced that showed if you take a vegan and give them a piece of red meat, they won't generate much TMAO. But if you give a meat eater a piece of red meat, then their TMAO levels go skyrocket. And that is because of the microbes that are in the guts of each of those populations. So if you eat vegan, plant-based, you will select for a bacteria in your colon that does not produce trimethyl. It's a metabolite that is very involved in inflammation, trimethylamine oxide. But it is found, so when you eat meat, basically the breakdown of the precursors of choline and carnitine and phosphatidylcholine, which is lecithin, break down in the presence of the bacteria in the colon to generate trimethyl amine oxide, which is damages the endothelial cell, causes inflammation, and increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. There have been studies done looking at, you know, ways to reduce TMAO. Best way is to get rid of animals out of your diet, especially red meat and eggs and dairy. Interesting, I had a patient that dropped her TMAO levels when she went plant-based, and her primary care doctor said, that's great, it must be secondary to the probiotic that I recommended you take. Well, there's actually been studies looking at giving people probiotic to try to change their gut flora and to decrease the TMAO levels, and it doesn't work. That's the bottom line. If you think about it, if you're a meat eater and you know you have a, you know, it's not like you have three bacteria in your gut. So taking a pill with a few strains of bacteria that won't grow in the presence of decaying animal flesh is not going to really do anything. It's like trying to plant a garden, you know, in the middle of a road. It just doesn't work. You have to have something that nourishes good bacteria in your colon, and that usually is fiber, plant foods. If you eat dead and decaying things, oils, things that disrupt the mucosa of the gut lining, you're going to select for a bacteria population that, again, is going to make more of this TMAO. So they tried to do it, again, given probiotics, it didn't work. The other thing that they did, there was a study done that looked at probiotic therapy to try to decrease weight gain and levels of TMAO. And they took patients and they randomized them to either placebo, which was a cornstarch tablet or pill, versus probiotics after they put them on a high-fat diet, 55% fat. And there was no change in their weight, and there was an increase in TMAO in both groups. So giving people probiotics doesn't help them not gain weight with eating a high-fat diet, and it also does not help decrease the TMAO production. And you might say, well, how does a probiotic help you lose weight? Of course, if you look on the, you know, people selling things, they'll tell you that it does everything from grow hair to lose weight to everything else. But the idea is that when you take a probiotic and you change your microflora, your bacteria, that some bacteria actually extract calories from your food. So if you have bad bacteria, I also, you know, I'm going to call them bad bacteria because they're, you're not supposed to really be extracting calories in your colon, but just like a cow can extract calories using the bacteria that it harbors, people that have bad bacteria from eating dead and decaying foods can they actually extract more calories. So you have somebody that's overweight that eats an animal-based diet, has a gut microbiome that actually extracts more calories. So the thought was if you give people probiotics and you change their gut flora, then they won't extract so many calories and they'll lose weight. Well, that didn't help because basically you can't just put probiotics in a pill and expect them to grow and take over the bad bacteria. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that this high-fat diet. And what's a high-fat diet? A ketogenic diet. So when people say, oh, I went on a ketogenic diet and my hemoglobin A1C normalized and I lost all this weight, well, you lost all this weight by increasing your TMAO levels. So you can be skinny and have a heart attack just like you can be fat and have a heart attack. And if you want to be skinny and have a heart attack, you can do you know, a high-fat ketogenic diet. So, you know, yet another reason not to go down this road of a ketogenic diet and a high-fat diet. And again, another reason to stay away from quick fixes. You know, you can't take a, you know, people don't want to take a statin as a quick fix for their cholesterol. They don't want to take a blood pressure as a quick fix for a blood pressure pill for a quick fix of their blood pressure. But if they're taking something that they can buy themselves, like a probiotic, they're all in because they, you know, it's, again, it's a control factor. You're not being told you have to do it. I'm going to fix myself and I'm going to take this. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, eat what I'm eating, and then I'll take a probiotic and everything will be okay. Not so. taking that one step further and looking at cardiovascular disease, again, I'm still stewing a little bit about, you know, a comment I got that maybe I should stay away from COVID because and not have an opinion. But again, I still do and read the medical literature about COVID. But interestingly, in Nature magazine, Science magazine this month, they looked at why kids do better with COVID than adults. If you look at the CDC information in COVID, in people less than 17 years of age, they are 22% of the population of the United States. But they only have attained 2% of the cases, the confirmed cases of COVID. And that amounted to about 2,572 children. And about 5.7% of all of those were hospitalized. There were three deaths, a little bit of controversy around those. But nevertheless, if we say that that's what happened, basically it's a pretty low infectivity rate. And most of the time, and we're finding out more and more each week that, you know, a lot of kids don't even have any symptoms of COVID. They might test positive for COVID, but they've never had any symptoms, or they have mild symptoms. And so why does this happen? Why are they doing better than adults? And one of the reasons is their overall immunity. Kids tend to have a better immune system than adults. We know that as you age, your natural killer cells, which are part of your white blood cells that are your first line of defense when you get infected, decline with age. So that's one reason. So kids have more natural killer cells, and they work better than older adults. The older you are, the sicker you are, the lower your natural killer cells. The more medications you're on, the lower your natural killer cells. So your ability to defend yourself goes way down. The other thing that might be a part of it is that kids are often exposed to other kids, and they're always getting, you know, runny noses and the common cold. And one of the common cold viruses is a coronavirus. And it may be such that being exposed to some of these other common cold viruses, like coronaviruses, a different strain, kind of primes the immune system. So their immune system is on the ready for SARS-CoV-2 that we have now, that, you know, it's close enough that they can mount immune response and not get really sick. And then the other thing, which is very interested in being studied much more currently, is that the blood vessels of children are healthier than adults. And this is true. It would be true if, everybody would say, yeah, I would guess that kids don't have coronary artery disease. The scary thing is that we're starting to see coronary artery disease in teenagers and young adults. Even in their 30s, we see people with significant coronary artery disease and heart disease, and certainly in people that do cocaine and other drugs can have significant coronary artery disease. But nevertheless, if you're a healthy child or young adult, you have normal endothelial cells, and that may be very protective because adults that do poorly with COVID seem to have a lot of clotting. And they have clotting that causes heart attacks, clotting that causes strokes, clotting that causes peripheral vascular disease, and end up with extremities that are compromised. And it's thought to be secondary to endothelial dysfunction. And again, coronary artery disease, we talk about it all the time. What can you do if you have endothelial dysfunction? We know that if you have olive oil, coconut oil, safflower oil, avocado oil, chicken breast, animal fat, and your blood vessels constrict for 3 to 6 hours, and that ultimately results in endothelial damage. So when you're chronically exposed to inflammatory things, you get endothelial damage, you get plaques under the arteries with cholesterol and fat and white cells, and it results in endothelial dysfunction. So instead of your arteries dilating, your arteries actually constrict, and then they're more susceptible to clotting. If you cut yourself, if you cut your skin, your blood vessels, your clotting system is turned on, you form a blood clot so you don't bleed to death. Same thing happens inside. If you have disruption of the endothelial lining of your blood vessels, it's seen as a cut, and the clotting factors are turned on and a blood clot forms. If the blood clot obstructs the complete artery, then you have an infarction. So whether it's infarcting towards your heart, which would be a heart attack, or it's infarcting towards your head, it would be a stroke. Or if you have a complete occlusion to your leg, it could be a blue leg, cold leg. So if it doesn't completely obstruct, then that could be angina, or could be a TIA, or could be claudication when you walk. So that's all. Those are all endothelial dysfunction. And so what can you do? We know the answer, right? It's nitric oxide producing greens. So you eat cabbage and kale and collards and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and beets and spinach and Swiss chard and mustard greens. And it interacts with the microbacteria in your tongue and amylase in your sputum, and you make nitric oxide. If you're still eating animal products and you try it, it won't work because there's another mechanism that will block it. So one of the ways that you can help yourself with, you guessed it, COVID infections is to eat your nitric oxide producing greens. So kids that have normal endothelial cells get along just fine. Adults with endothelial damage, which will also be a result in high blood pressure. So high blood pressure by definition means that there's an abnormality in the blood vessel wall that it can't dilate appropriately. Again, are all more susceptible to the damaging effects of COVID. So they're doing studies to look at just what part, what interaction or what could be done. And again, I want to raise my hand. I think I have the answer that, again, we reverse lifestyle diseases and we make our population more healthy, and that we turn COVID into more of a cold than a flu-like illness. And before anybody gets all bent out of shape that I said flu-like illness, there's a... I'll refer you to a Stanford researcher by the name of Michael Levitt, and he was talking about the statistics of COVID, and the reality of it is the majority, again, just like the other studies have pointed to, the majority of deaths occur in a much older population. And if you look at the percentages of people that die, it is essentially like the flu. Older people have a risk of dying from bronchitis, the flu, a pneumococcal pneumonia. They have a weakened immune system, weakened respiratory muscles. They're at risk for any infectious disease that may come their way. Gallbladder disease, from infected bacteria in their gallbladder can take them out. So the same thing with COVID, it tends to affect older individuals, people that aren't healthy, people with a weakened immune system, much like the flu. So again, we need to turn our attention towards what can we do to make our population healthier. And, improve endothelial function by getting your greens in. People say, I have trouble getting them in. Again, soup, throw your greens in soup. If you're going to make a sandwich, make sure you have, a salad on the side. Make sure you have, some greens on the side with every meal. It can be cauliflower in your stir fry or Brussels sprouts. You can have two side you can have beets and Brussels sprouts in the same meal. Cabbage is a very cheap, good old head of big green cabbage is very cheap, and you can do all kinds of things with it. Put that in your salads. You can do a stir fry. You can do cabbage rolls. There's a whole host of things that you can do to get those greens in every day. So always every day, look at your plate and say, did I have my greens? If you didn't have your greens, you need to go back to the drawing board. You're not having an adequate lunch or dinner, especially. And if you're actively having heart disease symptoms, then throw them in the mid-morning if you can. Some people eat a savory breakfast. Again, if you have a tofu egg sandwich, like in our cookbook, you can throw it on a bed of greens. Makes a great tofu scramble, a great savory breakfast to do that as well. So there's lots of ways to get around it, but make sure you have your greens in. So that's basically where I'm going to leave it today, there's a lot we can do to help ourselves. I think that one of the other things that we can do is be kind. And somebody asked me in class today, and we did have nutrition class today in my office, as well as on Zoom for people that don't want to come in. And they asked me, should we go and visit our relatives up in Massachusetts? And they're 75 years old. And I said, you know, this is like a family reunion that hasn't occurred. They haven't seen them for over a year. And I said, you know, do you want to see them? Because obviously if they're relatives that you're not fond of, then there's probably no risk, no need to do it. No, we really would like to see them, and they would really like to see us, but we're not sure of where they've been. And it's like, at 75, how many times do you think you're going to get to visit relatives that you haven't seen for a long time? It could be maybe if it's once a summer, maybe it's five more summers, maybe it's not. How long do you think your people will be able to travel? And I think you have to take that into consideration. The risk, may not be, the benefits of seeing family, of the kindness that can be involved, to be near others, and it can be a lifetime experience that might be the best thing that happens in the last 5 years of somebody's life. So to take that away from somebody, I think is, not a good idea. But people have to make their own judgment on that. But I think that when we look at seniors and we're isolating them and keeping them away from birthday parties and graduations, and we're keeping kids away from graduations especially, I think that we're not doing the right thing at this point. So that's my take on it. Yes, I know that the numbers are increasing right now since we've opened up, and that makes perfect sense. The hospitalizations don't seem to be, but we have to get herd immunity, and a safe vaccine is not going to become available anytime soon. If a vaccine does become available, it's not going to be tested. So the best thing you can do is to make yourself healthy, and let people that are going to tolerate this well get out and enjoy themselves, play sports, go to school, interact with other kids, socially developed, be kind. And I think our world would be a lot better. And for the rest of us, there is a risk of living. The older that you get, the more risk you have of dying. It is not your fault if somebody else gets dies of an infectious disease. You wash your hands, you do your best, but there's only so much you can do. You can't live in a bubble for the rest of your life because this might be out of here. And I think, frankly, it hasn't burned out quicker because, we're not letting the people that can be out and tolerate this well get the exposure and get our herd immunity. So that's my take on it. It's a free podcast. I do the editing. That's my opinion. But for now, exercise, the best thing you can do, get your lung function great. Don't inhale any toxins that you don't vape. Get out in the environment and, inhale some good microbiomes and good bacteria. Eat your fiber, eat your food that'll support a good microbiome. Stay away from animal products, and life will be good. And I hope you have a good week, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you for listening.